It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, the state Supreme Court ruled that it would not disclose the identities of 11 priests listed in a grand jury report detailing accusations of sexual abuse that took place over decades in dioceses across the state. The Confluence's Megan Harris spoke to WESA's race and identity reporter, Virginia Alvino Young, about both the ruling and the latest in the ongoing investigation.
Virginia, welcome back to the Confluence.
Thanks so much.
What reasoning did the court give for siding with the 11, for now, unidentified priests named in the report?
So basically taking the side of the 11 who had presented a legal challenge to having their name published in this grand jury report, right? So they had argued that they weren't given the opportunity to defend themselves or present their cases in the grand jury investigation. So they, you know, failed to provide adequate due process protections for themselves. And constitutional rights are in the highest order, according to the majority opinion, although the justices did sympathize with those that the decision hurt.
And Pennsylvania is kind of unique. A person's reputation is considered a fundamental individual human right.
Right. It all sort of came about from that right to reputation piece. That was kind of the core of their argument.
So these 11, they aren't the first alleged predator priests whose names have been shielded.
No. So the diocese all like to say that they've been fully transparent, but there's been a lot of pushback from victims and from activists to say, you know, you're only doing things when you have to, but they say that they've been transparent and they have published in full the names minus these 11. There's been a push for the diocese themselves to just publish the names since they're not barred from doing so, but none have. But the thing about the grand jury report is it says, you know, here's about 300 so-called predator priests that are implicated one way or another, right? These aren't criminal charges. It's showing evidentiary support about their implication in sexual assault and abuse of children. But what we know since the grand jury report has been released is that a lot more people have come forward with their own stories. So the 1,000 or so victims that are identified in the report, many more have come forward with their own stories and have named priests. So priests have been put on administrative leave since then. Some are, you know, deceased who are named. But the thing is, some priests have been named who were not previously identified before, and they have been placed on leave as well.
Many of those who have been named came to be known by investigators through a website set up by the Attorney General's office. Where's the onus for investigation? Is it still falling to the diocese, or are state investigators taking the lead?
So many dioceses have their own internal investigations that they take part in. The Pittsburgh diocese says and, you know, has followed their protocol that was in place before the grand jury report. So no matter how they're hearing about it, the diocese has their own sort of, you know, hotline to report things. So whether it comes to them directly or whether it comes through the Attorney General's office, their protocol is to take that information, pass it along to authorities who then take on that investigation, you know, and investigation themselves. And also, you know, with credible allegations to place that priest on leave should they still, you know, be alive.
How is this affecting the community? Not just the congregants, the faithful, but survivors of assault as well.
The faithful who, right, this group of people who are still attending the diocese and still participate in the diocese, a lot of what they have said is that, you know, this is about their faith, not about the institution. These are the mistakes of men. And so for the same reason that they stuck by the diocese side before is the same reason that they're staying now. And, you know, not that all of them are excusing what has happened. There's sort of varying degrees of defense there. Many of them say that they do want people to be held accountable, but the catch is, you know, should they be found criminally guilty? And there's a lot. That's a very loaded situation right now. But as far as survivors, this was a big blow. I mean, we just came out of a legislative session where statute of limitations reform was not passed. And so they're really saying now it's more important than ever to be exploring changes to the legal system where they can pursue things like criminal charges for priests.
That legislation would have allowed a 2-year window for victims whose crimes occurred many years ago to sue for monetary damages, plus no statute of limitations for any new victims. The church, of course, countered with a proposed compensation fund. Where does that stand right now?
So, I mean, several dioceses across the state, right, have proposed this victims compensation fund. When that legislation, that civil window legislation, was still on the table. This was their alternative. They said, you know, let's do this instead. It's going to expedite payments. It's going to ensure that victims are provided with something and kind of spare them this lengthy and painful process of litigating their cases. So, you know, now the statute of limitations reform is not currently being explored. And they're saying, you know, we're going to move forward with this victims compensation fund. Details from the Pittsburgh Diocese have been promised by the end of the year, but no word since about amounts, timelines, all of those details are yet to be seen.
Is there any chance or appetite for legislation to be picked up again in the January session?
It's tough because it was first being explored right on the heels of this report when there was a lot of passion behind this issue and a lot of, you know, vocal activists and some legislators as well. I believe that those folks will still be there and are obviously still paying attention and still care about this a lot. But if it'll still carry the weight after already failing to pass several times, I don't know.
So what would the financial impact be for the Pittsburgh Diocese if litigation ever became an option for past or future crimes?
That's a tough one, right? Because they've already spent millions of dollars handling individual settlements, and these obviously have affected very few survivors in the grand scheme of how many there really are and how many have yet to come forward. But, you know, what they said when the litigation really was being considered by the legislature, the diocese, diocese across the state said that this would bankrupt us if we had to deal with just this flood of lawsuits happening all at the same time. And that's where this alternative really comes from, saying, let's just create a fund to compensate these victims.
And so how are advocates, survivors, taking this as we enter into what certainly for Catholics is a holy season?
It's tough, again, and I would take it back. I mean, there are people who are survivors as well who still identify as Catholic, saying it's a matter of faith. I'm identifying with my faith and my relationship with God as opposed to, you know, what my relationship is with this institution who may have harmed me in some way. So many of the holiday events are still being planned, all of the special services and masses for the diocese at large, for specifically like the Latino community. All of these things are still happening, and there's obviously still plenty of attendance. And so we'll see. I think it would be a very personal decision for someone to say that my holiday season has taken on a new meaning or significance in light of everything that's played out this year.
Virginia, how will you be covering this ongoing story in weeks to come?
There's so much coming up still. I mean, what we have is a recent congregating of bishops across the country where they were supposed to entertain changes to how they deal with things like this, but they ended up not. There's going to be another convening next year. So we're going to be keeping a close eye on if that has an impact locally on parishioners and if they feel like the diocese is actually following through on some of the things that it's promised to do. They've already taken some actions. They're reviewing a lot of their procedures, the Pittsburgh dioceses, and things like that. But we're going to be waiting to see what the compensation fund looks like, how that plays out, and really, yeah, how folks are responding to not just the words, but the actions of the diocese going forward.
Virginia Alvino-Young is WESA's identity reporter. Virginia, thanks so much for being here.
Anytime.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. There's a familiar sound of the siren of a fire truck as it zooms down the street. But the sounds associated with fire alerts have changed over time. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports on the unique alerts of fire stations around the Pittsburgh region.
Shiny red trucks, long colorful hoses, and thick fire jackets line the garage of the Cochrane Hose Company in Sewickley. The space is filled with firefighters chatting, radio dispatch murmurs, and occasionally... What is that noise? That was the question posed by listener Luke Tittman, who used to work in Sewickley.
Everything else is, you know, what you're used to hearing. It's this thing, this buzzer that sounds very different.
Sewickley Safety Chief Jan Von Hofen says he knows the answer. It begins in 1876, when the volunteer department was founded for the same reasons as most stations.
There was things burning down, and the community felt the need for a fire department.
Sewickley's department operated much like other Western Pennsylvania stations in the 19th century.
It started with a hand-drawn hose cart, and they got water from wells and cisterns.
When there was a blaze, Von Hofen says officers would be alerted and rushed to the station. There, they'd ring a large bell to call other volunteers. But over time, Vonhoeffen says, the bells broke, and the station decided to buy a sturdy, game-well diaphone.
It was designed initially as a fire horn. A lot of people think they were boat horns or ship horns or whatever, or from mill, but it was always designed as a fire horn.
This air-powered metal horn was a popular model for fire stations. It was programmed to blow different cadences based on the location of the fire. It's not like that anymore, Vonhoeffen says. Usually the horn blasts for about 16 seconds. Other stations still have horns, but many don't use them because residents complained about the noise.
There's people that hate it, and there's people that think it serves a need, and we're trying to get a happy balance somewhere in between.
Most volunteer departments use sirens. The City of Pittsburgh fire stations don't use either. Historian Edward Ross says that's because in 1870, when the department was established, city firefighters were paid. They weren't volunteers. So there was always someone on staff, no need to call for them. Around 1880, the city installed Gamewell fire alarm boxes in neighborhoods. Ross says these metal devices were typically red or yellow and fixed to poles on street corners.
A local policeman or a resident would often have the key, and when there was a fire, you would open the box up and pull a hook down.
That hook would trigger an electrical signal that corresponded to the box's number. A telegraph-like system would transfer the location to the fire dispatch center.
If you pulled a fire box, it was box 124, bells would ring 1, then 2, and then 4.
Most firemen knew their station's numbers by heart. Ross says before motorized engines, even the horses recognized the bell patterns. Eventually, vandalism and technological changes made these boxes less useful, and the city took them down in the 1980s.
These days, with everyone having telephones and cell phones, all alarms are phoned into the 911 center.
But at the Cochrane Hose Company in Sewickley, Jan Vonhoeffen says the fire horn has become a way for volunteers to easily recognize their station's calls.
If you're ever with a group of firemen and you're outside in the distance, you hear a siren go off, they all look at each other because they don't know whose it is. Ours go off, they all look at us because they know whose it is. So it's very distinctive.
I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Good Question is a regular feature on 90.5 WESA, where we investigate what you've always wondered about Pittsburgh. Check out more of our series and submit something of your own at wesa.fm/goodquestion. You're listening to The Confluence.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, the Clairton Coke Works is a big polluter in southwestern Pennsylvania, but it's also a big job provider, and many want to keep it running, lest they end up a ghost town like their neighbors across the Mon Valley. Later this hour, a special look at Clairton and the people who live in the shadow of industry. Plus, a brief glimpse at what Pittsburgh's mayor has to say in Poland for the conference to battle climate change. Hear more interviews, conversations, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pittsburgh the Movie debuts in 1942. The film starred Marlena Dietrich and John Wayne, who played Charles, aka Pittsburgh Markham, a power-hungry coal miner trying to move up in the thriving steel industry. Part of the movie was shot in Pittsburgh. It included themes of patriotism and sought to encourage workers to labor harder to help efforts during World War II. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today, a re-air of a story from December 2017. We hear from Dave Rangan of Lawrenceville United, whose work with the PEP Rally program has helped strengthen the neighborhood's public schools. 90.5 WESA's Joaquin Gonzalez has the story.
Good to see you.
Dave Brengen is walking through the gym at Arsenal Middle School. Most of the kids here recognize him and say hi.
Hey, Turcano. What's up? How are you?
Brengen knows the kids through his involvement in PEP Rally, which he describes as a triangular link between Lawrenceville's families, the public schools, and the neighborhood's wider community.
And trying to make each of those different points on the triangle more accountable to each other and bringing them together ultimately to benefit children in our neighborhood.
Lawrenceville United, a nonprofit dedicated to improving quality of life in the neighborhood, started Pep Rally in 2013 during a period of declining enrollment at the community's public schools, Arsenal Elementary, Arsenal Middle, and Woolslayer Elementary. Brengen was the program's first staff member. He says he started out going door to door in the neighborhood talking to parents, and he found that a lot of them hadn't gotten many chances to get involved with the schools.
I heard a lot of things like, what is it even like inside the school? You know, can we come and see the school? There's a pool in Arsenal, really?
Monica Tillman, who's been a social worker at Arsenal for 25 years, says school staff usually just don't have the time to bring people in from the community.
A lot of our staff not only work with the children during the day, but they work with them after school. They're their coaches, they're tutoring kids, and so their day is pretty full.
Pep Rally started bringing teachers and families together at neighborhood events like a Halloween party. And that led to more collaborations within the schools. At Arsenal, for example, Pep Rally partnered with Goodwill to create a program where the parents of English as a second language students could come and take their own English classes in the evenings. In 2013, Woolslayer's enrollment was down to just over 100 students, and Pittsburgh Public Schools had recommended that it close. Brengen and Pep Rally worked with parents and teachers to create a successful proposal to revitalize the school as a partial magnet for science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Tillman says Pep Rally has played an important role in Arsenal's success.
When parents and school staff can partner, it only strengthens what you provide for young people.
Over the last 4 years, Arsenal Middle School and Woolslayer have both been recognized multiple times by the district for their students' improvements in standardized test scores. And since 2014, enrollment at Woolslayer has doubled. Rebecca Ferrer says when she moved to Lawrenceville in 2015, Brengen and Pep Rally helped her acclimate and choose Woolslayer for her kids.
It was really helpful in deciding about the school and really helpful in deciding about the neighborhood and getting involved in the neighborhood. I'm the kind of person who, if there was an email blast, I might ignore it, or kind of an introvert. So it's really helpful to have the person to person.
Last year, Brengen transitioned to a new role at Lawrenceville United, executive director. He says he wants to cast a wider net in making Lawrenceville more family-friendly. Next up, fighting to make housing more equitable as the neighborhood continues to gentrify. I'm Joaquin Gonzalez, 90.5 WESA News.
Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Since the passage of the Clean Air Act, air quality in the U.S. has been steadily improving. But near Pittsburgh, the air around a large U.S. steel facility is actually getting worse. Local regulators say the plant is to blame and have been in a tug of war with the company for decades over pollution. In the second installment of the Allegheny Front series about communities bearing the brunt of pollution, Reed Frazier reports the county's efforts to clean up the plant might have reached a turning point.
Inside a small conference room in the Allegheny County Health Department, the region's air quality may hang in the balance. U.S. Steel is appealing a penalty to its Clairton Coke Works, a mammoth industrial facility about 20 miles to the south along the Monongahela River. U.S. Steel is appealing an order that threatens to put part of the plant on standby if the company doesn't address what the county says are persistent air quality violations there. During a break in testimony, Matt Mahalik of the Breathe Collaborative, an environmental group, says this day has been a long time in coming.
Well, what signifies is that the county is enforcing air quality regulations. It was clear today from some of the testimony, to me at least, that the county is following through on its authority.
At issue is a penalty imposed by the county that says if the plant doesn't improve, the county will order parts of it to be put on hot idle. That's where coke ovens are kept hot, but no coke is produced. The company is claiming this could damage its equipment and cost it up to $400 million. U.S. Steel didn't respond to interview requests, but in an email, the company said it would continue its appeal, calling the penalty unprecedented. At the appeal hearing, a lawyer for the company questioned whether the county had devised its standards for compliance on sufficient scientific study. Citing the appeal, Health Department Director Karen Hacker declined an interview request. But in testimony at the appeal hearing, county officials said Clairton has been on hot idle before, with no apparent damage. And they say the penalty was the best way to get the company to clean up what the county is describing as deteriorating conditions at the Clairton Coke Works. Rachel Filippini is watching the case closely. She's executive director for the Group Against Smog and Pollution, and says the county has tried and failed to control pollution at Clairton for decades.
This is the scenario that we see over and over again.
Regulators reached major settlements of pollution violations with U.S. Steel in 1979, 1993, 2007, 2008, 2014, and 2016. But each time, Filippini says, the company failed to meet its requirements.
In the meantime, they're continuing to pollute and people are continuing to get sick and die. And then a couple of years later, another fine is issued.
After the 2016 judgment, emissions from the plant actually got worse, the county says. Overall, compliance with local air laws declined from 94% in 2014 to just 75% this year. Among the biggest problems are emissions from the doors of coke ovens, which can leak out a laundry list of pollutants like fine particles, which can go deep into the lungs, and carcinogens like benzene. But in January, the health department enacted a strict new enforcement policy. And in June, it issued $1 million fine and set a time limit for the plant to clean up. If it didn't fix its pollution problems, the plant would have to put its two worst performing coke batteries on hot idle. So is the county taking a new, tough stance on Clairton? Filippini says she's not sure yet.
I mean, we've been doing this for 5 decades, and so we've been disappointed in the past. So we are, I guess, cautiously optimistic.
Filippini wants the county to do whatever it takes to get the plant to cut pollution, but not everyone shares her attitude. Rich Latanzi is the mayor of Clairton. He's also a steelworker who works at another U.S. steel plant nearby, the Irvin Works in West Mifflin.
This is our new produce store here, by the way. This marketplace that just opened up about 3 weeks ago. We had all the big shots in here from Harrisburg and so on and so forth.
He's taking me on a tour of the town in his SUV. Clairton once had 25,000 residents. Now there's just 6,000. Latanzi says he's trying to keep the town from sinking any further. We pull into the crowded parking lot in front of the Coke Works. 1,000 people work here. Trucks haul steaming hot piles of freshly made coke out the front gate. Coke is nearly pure carbon and a key component in steelmaking. It's made by baking coal at 2,000 degrees inside coke ovens. Inside the plant perimeter, we see huge billows of steam pour out of tall stacks.
Yeah, that's a quencher tower right there. That's all steam.
The quenching tower cools off hot coke, just as it's come out of hot ovens, and pushed into transport cars.
When it falls out, it lands in these cars. Then the car gets full, it moves forward, and it's all glowing orange. It goes down a little bit, then it goes under these quenching towers, and I don't know how many they have, but that's whenever they drop all this water for like 2-3 minutes, and they quench it down.
Latanzi, who's 54, says the air here has gotten better. He remembers when pollution from the coke works left the hillside across the Monongahela River barren rock. As we cross a bridge over the river, he points up a hillside, now covered in trees.
Years ago, nothing was able to grow, nothing. Even this right here is crazy to have trees here. It was all like stones and nothing.
Later, we stop at a hillside overlooking the plant. Steam pours out of several quenching towers, but a blue pall also hovers over one part of the plant.
That's what we're concerned with. The blue smoke that you see definitely would be some of the gases or vapors escaping from an oven that's making the coal, and it doesn't have a good seal. It's probably either a poor design or it's an older battery.
Latanzi says he wants the county to fix problems like that smoke. But at the same time, he's worried. The Coke Works makes up a third of the tax base for the city, and he would never want it to shut down.
But at the end of the day, do you realize what happened to the city of Clairton and the city school district if we closed that mill down? We would not be here today. We'd be like a ghost town.
But the plant's struggles to curb air pollution are causing a drop in air quality, the county says. Clairton's air is some of the worst in the country. In a minute, we'll see what it's like to breathe it. For The Confluence, I'm Reed Frazier. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front. In the second installment of our series on how pollution is impacting people's health, we're focused on one of the largest sources of air pollution in Pennsylvania, U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works, just southeast of Pittsburgh. Allegheny County, which regulates the plant's air emissions, says Clairton has been backsliding on pollution controls over the last 4 years, and because of this, air quality nearby is getting worse. I went to Clairton to learn what it's like to live next to North America's largest coke works. Zi-Hao Li is crouching on a metal-grated platform on a bluff overlooking the Clairton Coke Works. The plant below sprawls 3 miles along the Monongahela River, and steam and smoke rise from towers and equipment scattered throughout the complex. Li is a graduate student at Carnegie Mellon University. He's looking at a small computer screen hooked up to air monitoring equipment, showing readouts about current wind conditions.
Wind data, wind direction, wind speed.
Li is part of a research team experimenting with low-cost air quality monitors to give a better sense of what the air is like in the region. Knowing which direction the wind is blowing is key to understanding how pollution here is dispersed, Li says.
First, we get the wind right, then we can see if the pollution will follow the wind.
The air Li and the other scientists are monitoring is, officially, some of the dirtiest in the country. According to EPA data, an air monitor 1 mile north of here now registers the highest year-round levels of fine particles east of the Rockies and is the only monitor in the county that violates EPA standards for these particles. Albert Presto is the Carnegie Mellon scientist overseeing the monitoring project. He says the reason the air here is so bad is because of large industrial sources of pollution.
And the big source, sort of the 800-pound gorilla, is the Clairton Coke Works.
Presto says this pollution can have health effects, like increasing the risk of heart attacks and lung disease, but also asthma. Presto says that between 50 and 100,000 people live close enough to the plant to be affected by its pollution.
You know, on one hand, there are 1.2 million people in the county, you know, so it's 10-ish percent. On the other hand, that's 100,000 people who are living with a level of risk that's deemed unacceptable by the EPA.
Remember, big breath in. Hard and fast out. Go, 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 go. Keep going. Go, 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 go. All right. You needed to practice.
In the nurse's office at Clairton Elementary School, Nicole Sawson gives sixth grader Savon Williams a breathing test. He's blowing into a tube that measures his lung capacity. On a computer screen, Savon watches a cloud rise or fall, depending on how hard he's blowing into the tube. The goal is to get the cloud to stay in the middle of the screen. Sawson is a project coordinator for a Duquesne University team that set up a twice-monthly asthma clinic here. The team screens students, teaches them about taking inhalers, and helps parents keep medication on hand for their kids. After his breathing test, Williams sits down with Dr. Deborah Gentile.
How have you been feeling?
Good.
Good. Are you having any problems?
I use my inhaler because I was coughing.
Yeah. Are you using your rescue a lot?
Gentile's team has been in the school for 4 years. She says Savon was one of the first students they saw.
When we first met him, he was what we would call a severe persistent. He was basically using his rescue med multiple times a day, every single day, going to the emergency room every couple weeks. So he's really come a long way.
Clairton is one of several sites she's studying to determine what impacts air pollution has on kids with asthma. Gentile's team found asthma rates at Clairton double the countywide rate. She thinks the pollution from the Clairton Coke Works is causing at least some of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple triggers, but this bad air is one that is affecting everyone, and it's not just a disease of asthma. You know, it's not like if we close this plant, all these kids, their asthma's not going to totally go away, but it's probably going to improve.
There are lots of factors that put Savon at greater risk for asthma. African-American boys, for instance, have higher rates of asthma than other kids. But Gentile says the closer the kids she studied lived to a big pollution source, the greater the chance they'd have asthma.
So if you stand like on that side over there, or like if you look right in between that building right there, you can see the mill right there.
From her front porch, Savon's mother, Colette Williams, points out the coke plant a half mile away in the valley below.
Yeah, that's like a white smoke, and then over there is like a dark smoke.
In her living room, she pulls out a handful of plastic pill boxes and inhalers.
So that's his albuterol solution. That's what goes in the machine.
Savon's on four medicines daily to keep his lungs open.
And this is his singular pill. It's just a chew pill that he takes every night. Cause drowsiness a little bit, but it's supposed to help with his asthma.
Savon has always had health problems, including asthma. All of Colette's four children were born prematurely, but Savon, she says, was the preemiest at 26 weeks. A respiratory infection when he was first born kept him in the hospital for 3 weeks. Colette Williams grew up in Clareton and moved to this house about 6 years ago. A few years after that, Savon's asthma got worse.
I started to see a change in his breathing, how often he got sick, what triggers his asthma.
He developed severe infections from getting colds. There were more doctor visits, more medications. Now 13, she says he can't play sports at a local field across the street from the Coke Works because the fumes from the plant can set him off. She won't let him play football in bad weather either because she's worried he'll get a bad cold that will set his breathing back for weeks. She blames the Coke Works, but says whenever she's complained to city officials, nothing ever happens. She says she understands the mill is a big employer in town, but her first priority has to be her son.
I'm really hurt and upset about my son because he can't be a normal kid. He can't run around and go play and, you know, stay over other kids' houses because I don't know how his asthma is going to react or how he's going to handle the situation when he's not around me. So I would be okay if they closed the mill.
She says barring that, she'd just like to see the plant clean up. And as we'll see in a moment, clean air activists are collecting stories like Savon's to convince regulators to take their health concerns seriously. That's up next. For The Confluence, I'm Reed Frazier. An environmental group is taking what seems like a simple tack to fight air pollution in Clareton. It's asking people there to share their stories, which is not always easy. But some are discovering the power of finding their voice. In the second installment of our series, looking at communities impacted by pollution, the Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple has this story.
Miriam Maletta opens her hair salon at 11 on Thursdays as her Yorkie, Nino, makes little circles on the linoleum floor.
Who's at the door? Who is it? Go see. Who is it? Go see.
Maletta has been in business here in Clareton for 34 years. She's lived here all her life, and that's evident as a cousin or a nephew pops by the shop to help with a community dinner she's hosting or just to check in.
You know, it's just a hometown. It's just family. We care about each other's children, care about each other. It is just a love that's here.
Maletta's so easy to talk to. And one of the things that her customers talk about when they come to see her is U.S. Steel's Clareton Coke Works, just down the hill.
We talk about how the community thrived when the mill was there. I used to tell a story when I was young. We used to love the smell that used to resonate from the mill, let off. We used to love that smell. Then now when I think about it, like, what was it doing to our health?
The steel mill here wound down its operations in the 60s, and the boomtown started its decline. But they still make coke here. And Maletta says living for decades with the pollution it creates has taken its toll.
You know, like my dad, he never drank, never smoked. He was a fighter, a boxer, welterweight, ranked number 4 in the world during his time. He was so healthy. And he one day just had stage 4 gastric cancer and was gone in 4 or 5 months.
A brother had asthma. And Maletta herself is a cancer survivor.
August 24th, 2016, I had diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, stage 4, which is cancer of the lymph nodes in my abdomen and my chest.
It was really painful, and she went through rounds of chemo and radiation. She showed me a photo of herself from her phone after she lost all her hair. According to a 2009 EPA report, air pollution raises Clareton residents' risk of getting cancer to about 20 times the national average. Miletta's in remission now, but after her own cancer and her dad's death,
it's really been something that it has been on my mind, like, what's going on? What's really going on?
So about 6 months ago, when she met Dave Smith from Clean Air Council outside her shop, and he asked her if he could talk with her about her health and her family, she said, sure.
I felt like when I was standing outside, it was meant for me to just meet him.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, Miriam. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I walked in here one day and said, can we talk? And we, you know, in no time, we're best buds. And I did an interview with her for the Legacy of Our Losses program.
Dave Smith has been working in Clairton for about a year and a half, going door to door, talking with people about their losses. Lost jobs, family members lost to illness. He's hoping to record and collect the stories of 100 residents and deliver them to the Allegheny County Health Department and Rich Fitzgerald, the county executive, and to U.S. Steel, if they're interested, he says. He's done about 20 interviews right here at the back of Miriam's salon alone.
You guys are kind of a team now because people are coming in here and you're doing interviews.
We are, but she's not doing my hair yet.
When we talked, he was working on Miletta's aunt, Wandra, who was having her hair curled with hot irons.
Not today? You still want to do it because of your hair? I think there's a lot of repressed feelings and grief here about how they've been impacted by the plant.
Smith says he just listens. He's good at it. He used to be a minister. But Miriam Miletta says even now, people are reluctant to speak out against the industry, even a polluting one. It employed their fathers and grandfathers, put food on their tables, and put them through college. And because of the way they've been treated.
Because people tend to not think they have a voice and they're not heard. And that's why I believe the mill has gotten away with this so long. You know, because this would be basically called the ghetto. And nobody pays attention. Oh, it's okay. You know, they're poor. You know, they live on, you know, the county assistance or whatever. Then they feel like, well, it doesn't matter. They're not going to pay any attention to it because they're not going to listen to us anyway. And I think that's really been the problem all these years.
But with Miletta's help and others in the community, Dave Smith says there's been some progress.
It's picking up steam because more and more people are opening up and want to talk. It empowers people when they tell their story and they realize, this is what I've been living and why. Why have I tolerated this?
In a few months, Smith will share these stories and hundreds of health surveys he and his group are also collecting. They want the Clairton Coke Works to clean up its act for good and for the county to invest in clean energy jobs here. Miriam Miletta wants to see people in her community become healthier and for Clairton to grow. And she says that's going to mean encouraging more people to stand up and tell their stories.
I don't want to be the one to sit back and say, oh, they should have done this. I want to be a part of something. And I feel like, you know, with me being healed from cancer, I feel like I do have a purpose. And maybe this is one of my purposes to kind of do something to help with this situation, this problem.
For The Confluence, I'm Kara Holsapple.
You can find all of our reporting on environmental health at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front, and you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Allegheny Front's coverage of environmental health is supported by the Pittsburgh Foundation and the Heinz Endowments. And finally, Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto is in Poland for the annual United Nations Conference on Battling Climate Change. Yesterday, the mayor visited the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial, the site of the former Nazi concentration camp. Leaders from around the world are gathered at the conference as they try to implement the Paris Climate Accords reached in 2015. Peduto is speaking on two panels during the conference, and he will speak this evening at the screening of the National Geographic documentary, Paris to Pittsburgh. The mayor returns to Pittsburgh Thursday. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, the city of Pittsburgh commemorated the 70th anniversary of International Human Rights Day by reaffirming a commitment to human rights. But what does that mean in policy, planning, and practice in the city? Plus, the Pittsburgh Ballet Theater is performing The Nutcracker. How does the organization use that as outreach to entice more ballet fans? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.